Cooper style adaptive mesh refinement is very well suited for a large range of problems in any numerical relativity. So I'll explain this algorithm in some detail. There's a sort of ideal for hyperbolic wave-like equations, but you can actually extend it for situations where you're also solving elliptic equations. In particular, if it's really the hyperbolic equations which are governing the dynamics of the system, and the elliptic equations are in some sense just they strongly couple to the dynamics of the matter that's been governed by hyperbolic equations. And I'll just sort of briefly mention this one particular library, PAMR, parallel adaptive mesh refinement, adaptive mesh refinement driver. Not very creative acronyms, but that implements one version of the Sperber-Oliger in parallel. And so I mean, if there was another week of labs, that this might be an ideal extension to try to parallelize and use this adaptive mesh refinement for one of the projects. But I'll just mention it, you know, those of you that are interested as extracurricular activity to try that. That's one of several libraries that can be used for this kind of procedure. Okay, so adaptive mesh refinement is a technique that is designed to more efficiently get a solution to certain classes of problems. And in particular, if there's a wide range of relevant scales that have to be evolved, in particular relevant length scales, and if these are not volume filling. So like with the binary merger problem, we have several orders of magnitude of length scales that we have to resolve, the wave zone, the orbital zone, and the individual black holes. But the black holes aren't volume filling, there are only two of them. And so for example, like if you looked at, say, an accretion disk, and the accretion disk becomes turbulent, so you're starting to generate small scale structures on, but essentially they're volume filling. Everywhere in the accretion disk, you're getting these small scale structures. Then this kind of mesh refinement algorithm will not be efficient. It's really only when you have isolated small-scale structures that you need to evolve that this can solve a problem much more efficiently than a uniform mesh. The other class of problem, which is where when you have that kind of a range of length scales, and why the adaptive part is useful is if you don't know where those small scales are going to be a priori. So with a binary merger, I mean, you can pretty much guess where the black holes are going. But for instance, if you add spin to the black holes, it's going to be precession. And especially in the final stages of the merger, the post-Newtonian estimates are not going to give you the correct trajectory. So you don't a priori and know where the binaries are going to go. So you want some method where the algorithm can tell you where it needs a resolution. So that's sort of the adaptive aspect of the algorithm. And of course, in some cases, it's computationally, at least with current computers, it's just impossible to solve one of these problems with a uniform mesh. If you do have a problem where adaptive mesh refinement could help, but you can solve it with a uniform mesh, you might as well go for it. It's going to cost a little bit more in terms of computer cycles, but that's fine. But in some classes of problems, you really need mesh refinement. So the way that the algorithm works is it takes your computational domain and covers it with a hierarchy of meshes, where the small scale features are covered by smaller, higher resolution meshes than the long length scale features. So I guess the one comment is mesh refinement here is not a way to get more accuracy in the solution. In fact, you'll never get more accuracy than a uniform mesh that covers the entire domain with the same resolution as your finest mesh. And that's in particular because at refinement boundaries, well, of course, in the lower resolution areas, that by definition is going to not be as accurate, but at refinement boundaries, you typically generate, quotes, noise. It's not really noise in any physical sense of the word noise, but you get high-frequency solution components that are not physical. They're usually quite small in magnitude. They can be controlled, if you do things right, they converge away, but it's going to make a typical AMR solution less accurate than a comparable unigrid one. So the point is not to get more accuracy, it's just to be able to resolve all the scales that you can get a solution. So in some sense, you might want to think of this as sort of at least this basic AMR with finite difference methods. If you're solving a new problem and you just want to get the answer in the first place. You're not interested in very high accuracy. This is a very convenient algorithm to use. I mean, there are ways in which you can get accuracy. You know, you can deal with some of these issues, but then it becomes much more complicated very quickly. But at least the basic algorithm, you can get an answer quite efficiently. So again, to sort of summarize a little bit of what I spoke about on Monday, why do we need it for general relativity, and in particular if we're thinking of compact object mergers? And that's because we do have a large range of scales to resolve. And so two orders of magnitude in the binary compact object problem, going from a compact object radius out to the radiation zone, where you can measure the gravitational waves. And in this case, as I mentioned, they're not volume filling. So the small length scales are confined to a small region of the domain. And so this kind of approach would be efficient. Now, even in just pure vacuum general relativity, that's not always going to be the case. For example, if you want to study cosmological singularities, so the BKL conjecture, this chaotic mixed master dynamics. So the approach to a singularity, those interesting structures that you'd need to resolve are volume filling. And so this basic kind of mesh refinement won't work very well for that. But at least there are a certain class of problems in GR where this is very well adapted. And also critical collapse is a good example. And I'll show you again that one animation that I showed on Monday. The other thing about GR is that in the strong field regime of compact object mergers, and in many different situations, the spatial scales, or when small spatial scale features develop, there's a corresponding temporal scale that develop. They're not decoupled. And that's one reason is, where there's a characteristic speed in the problem, the speed of light. So things travel at the speed of light. And in these compact object mergers, actually even the masses, the rest masses of the black holes and the neutron stars sort of approach the speed of light. But when there's some small scale feature developing, it's going to emit a gravitational wave of that characteristic size, and it's also going to propagate outwards at the speed of light. With critical collapse, it's the same thing. You're starting to develop scales on features on small scales, but they start to vary in time on the same kind of scales. So as a small length scale features develop, you need better resolution in time as well as in space. Now, one thing that this algorithm is going to miss is with compact objects, we're interested in the gravitational waves that are being emitted. Now, as a binary spiraling in, it's emitting waves, but this is a continuous emission of gravitational waves. So that's definitely not localized. It's going to be volume filling. So that's something where if you actually wanted to track the waves with high accuracy with mesh refinement, well, it will do it, but it will very quickly, your domain will fill with high resolution meshes and you'll lose all the benefits of what will become very inefficient to solve it. So this doesn't really work very well for tracking the waves. On the other hand, the waves are propagating into the weak field and you don't need very high resolution to get a pretty accurate estimate of the gravitational wave. So at least that's not too much of a problem. It's really only in the strong field around the compact objects where you typically need quite high resolution. And there are other ways in which you can sort of fix that, but at least luckily you think that might be a problem, but it's not, because it pretty coarse resolution does work for that. So what all of these preceding points about the situation that we're interested in suggest for an algorithm is, one is that it's not going to be too important to have very sophisticated grid structures that can efficiently track features of the solution. So we have two compact objects. We pretty much know where they are. We can just cover them with simple, uniform, aligned boxes. The one thing that is, however, important is that it's adaptive. That we can have a relatively simple grid structure covering the small n scale features, but we don't a priori know where those features are, so that the algorithm has to adapt to that. If several of you have read about various AMR algorithms, and in certain situations, fluid dynamics where you have a flow going along a complicated surface like an airplane wing or something like that, then you really need pretty complicated meshes and structures to efficiently resolve that. We don't have to do that. And in fact, in some sense, you could imagine, well, let's let's be as efficient as we can. Let's not put a square box around a black hole. Let's put a spherical grid around the black hole. And you can try and do that. Also, you know, if you have a neutron star which is tidally disrupted, well, let's just put a mesh along the little tidal stream of the neutron star. But one thing that becomes very complicated when you do stuff like that, it goes back to this noise that I mentioned that is typical at refinement boundaries. The more complicated your boundaries are, the more difficult it is to control that, to get it to a level which is reasonable. Yeah.
So are we going to use like methods similar to finite elements analysis, things with triangulation and things like
that? No, so this is just simple finite difference. Finite elements the method is much better adapted to fitting various shapes and various boundaries. It's sort of much more natural to do it with finite elements. But in some sense, then you start with that complicated thing to begin with. So what I'll show is sort of one of the benefits of Berggren-Olger style mesh refinement is you really don't write an adaptive code to begin with. You write a unigrid code. You get that working, you test it, you debug it, and then it's a relatively simple procedure to make it adaptive. You don't have to do much more. The algorithm takes care of it. And in these kinds of situations, that's good enough for a large class of problems. And if you apply this Berggren-Olger type thing with complicated boundaries, you'd find it would be a real pain to get to work. But you're right, like finite elements, in some sense, that's already been done from the beginning. They've really adapted the methods to triangulations. And so it's sort of, you put a lot more work in to begin with, and then it's sort of adaptable to a much larger range of scenarios. Here, you put in as little work as you can, and it's not going to work very well for general situations, but for at least a subset, it works well. Yeah. Okay. I mentioned a bit, again, the same thing about it. It's not going to track the gravitational waves. At least, we don't need too much resolution to resolve them, but there are other suggestions for how in GR, at least, you can get around that. For instance, if you have a Cartesian-like grid around the black holes, well, the gravitational waves, once they're sufficiently far away, are essentially going to be spherical-like wave fronts with some kind of multipolar structure. And then if you switch to a spherical polar type coordinate system, you'll be able to resolve it very efficiently with just a few multiple moments. So that's one suggestion. Other kind of suggestions is to change your slicing from a Cauchy-like slice to a null slice as you go away from the binaries, and so then actually follow them all the way to future null infinity. So there have been several suggestions, either sort of deform your slice in a smooth way or switch over to a characteristic code to get the waves to infinity in finite time. For the leading order answer to within a fraction of a percent, you don't have to worry about it. It's only if you really want the nth decimal of accuracy that you might want to look at things like that. Okay, so I'm going to describe the version of this Berggren-Olger algorithm, which is actually slightly simplified from what they described, but also extended a little bit in terms of suggesting how you'd solve elliptic equations if you wanted to. So this is the basic idea about the hierarchy. So this is, say, your computational domain. In this example, imagine there was a small-scale feature you wanted to resolve, or there was another one. And so instead of covering it with a single uniform mesh with that resolution, you cover it with this hierarchy of meshes, where a child mesh, which is higher resolution, is always entirely contained within some parent mesh. And so you form this hierarchy of meshes. And one of the important things about how you represent this grid structure in memory is you don't come up with some complicated data structure that represents this. You actually literally represent it as a sequence of unigrid meshes. In some sense, that might slightly make it, and the way that this algorithm works, as you'll see, is you always just solve the equations on a unigrid mesh. You don't worry about this complicated structure. You, as a user of this sort of mesh refinement infrastructure, you just write codes to solve difference equations on a unigrid mesh. And so there'll be a little bit of redundancy in the sense, for example, at that point, you'll solve the equations there, there, and there at the same point. And so you'll see sort of, you'll be doing a little bit of extra unnecessary work, but it turns out that, you know, if you figure out how much extra computation that's costing you, it's very little. It's sort of a logarithmic correction to the scaling of the algorithm. So in principle, you could try to make things more efficient, but it's not really worth it at the end of the day. And what this buys you is it keeps things very simple. As I mentioned, you don't have to worry about the fact that there's a complicated mesh. Essentially, the only difference, or the only thing that you have to be aware of when you write a code for this, is that a boundary, so you're solving your equations on some grid, you just have to be aware that a boundary might be a physical boundary or it might be an interior boundary. So for example, this boundary, you'd apply your physical boundary conditions. On this boundary, you just leave it alone. You don't do anything, and the AMR algorithm will take care of that for you. And yeah, so I'm saying, so this is sort of a simplified kind of hierarchy. The original Berger and Olliger also allowed these grids to be rotated, so a child could be rotated relative to a parent. And that was, again, they were thinking, again, for wave-like equations, if you have a wave that's propagating some wavefront, it's generically not going to be aligned with a grid structure, but if you rotated the grid, you could align it with a wave, and it might be a more efficient way of representing the hierarchy. But again, that adds the sufficient complication to the algorithm, and it also makes controlling boundary noise more complicated, and you don't really get much benefit from it. But just so keeping things to sort of aligned grids simplifies things quite a bit. So perhaps the most complicated part of the algorithm is how you evolve this structure in time. And it uses a recursive time-stepping algorithm. So in the next few slides, I'll sort of describe in words the algorithm, and then I'll give sort of a graphic example, and that will, you know, perhaps make it clearer. So you want to refine both in space and time for optimal efficiency. And the way that then this hierarchy is evolved in time is you take, for any particular level, you always take a single unigrid time step before you take a number of time steps on the child grid. Where this is the temporal refinement ratio, and that's usually equal to the spatial refinement ratio. So if you ever say a 2-to-1 refinement ratio in space, you also want a 2-to-1 refinement ratio in time. And that's so that you can keep the same current factor at throughout the hierarchy. And that's important for, you know, things like like general relativity, where you've got a physical speed of 1, you know, regardless of your domain. And so typically if you have, you know, matter that's doing something or black holes that's doing something on small scales, again, those spatial scales are going to be reflected in the time scale as well. So you sort of want to keep the same ratio between spatial and temporal time steps. So that's important for efficiency. If you didn't, you know, if you could in principle step the entire hierarchy with a single time step, but then for stability reasons that time step would have to be proportional to the smallest spatial scale in your hierarchy. So it's good for efficiency. It's also actually crucial for setting boundary conditions at the coarser levels, and it does so by interpolation from the parent level. Incidentally, there are other ways in which you can do this, where in principle you don't really set boundary conditions, and there's sort of this tapered method that Lewis and collaborators have come up with, and I'll briefly explain in words after I've shown you the AMR algorithm what that's about. But that method won't work if you're coupling it with elliptic equations. And it also adds a lot of communication costs to the problem if you have a large problem. But this also, again, I said, it allows this AMR technology to be implemented in a way where essentially the user doesn't have to be aware of the details of the algorithm, as long as you just know a physical boundary or not a physical boundary. So you take a single time step on the coarse mesh, then you take the finer steps on the fine mesh. When they're in sync in time again, then you inject the solution from the fine mesh to the coarse mesh, so that at any time when all the meshes are aligned in time, at every single point, the most accurate solution is always represented on that particular point in the grid. So in words, it might sound a little bit confusing, but when I give the example, next that will hopefully clarify things a little bit. Okay, so the other thing that's important is, okay, so you've got a particular mesh structure, you're stepping through, you're evolving it in time. The other thing is, how do you generate that mesh structure? How does it change? And there are various ways you could imagine, you know, adapting the mesh structure. For example, if you have a neutron star, you can say, well, let's track the region of highest density with a finest grid. But one thing that's most convenient, if this works, and for things like the Einstein equations or equations where you have smooth solutions, the truncation area is the best way to generate the mesh structure. So there are no shocks, there are no tricky things that you could worry about. If you do naive convergence with something like a fluid equation, you're going to get large numbers at places where it's really just an artifact of the fact that you've got a shock, not necessarily about the fact that you need more resolution. So if you have smooth solutions, or at least functions that have smooth solutions, you can use the truncation error essentially via the Richardson expansion to figure out your hierarchy. Now, in the original Bergen-Olger algorithm, what they proposed was you actually have two simultaneous hierarchies that you integrate in time. One is a two to one refined or coarsened version of your actual problem. And so periodically you initialize them to the same values, you step them, you evolve them for a while, and then you compare the solutions. And of course, if they differ by some refinement ratio, the difference in the solution is going to be proportional to the truncation error. And so then you find the region of high truncation error, you flag it, and based on that you generate the hierarchy. But actually, if you look at the way in which the time stepping works, as I'll show in the next few slides, you really don't need a copy of the hierarchy. In fact, in the injection phase of the algorithm, that truncation error estimate is essentially available for free. So you can really, they call this a shadow hierarchy. So you've got this coarsened grid that's shadowing the actual computation. But you can essentially, a hierarchy can cast its own shadow. You don't need a separate hierarchy. So this is sort of a self-shadow hierarchy where you just use the information that you get prior to injection to estimate the truncation error. The only extra thing that you have to do if you don't have an independent hierarchy is you need to sort of bootstrap the process. And by that I mean that what you consider to be your coarsest level is actually consists of two levels. So you pick, if level one is your coarsest, level n is your finest, you pick the resolution for level two to be what you want for your problem, and you fully refine level one and two, and that sort of bootstraps this process. Okay, so let's just briefly mention how you deal with elliptics. So the reason why this sort of time stepping works and why you can take a step on a coarse level and use interpolation to set boundary conditions on a fine level for elliptic equations is because it's got a finite speed of propagation. So on a very fine mesh, so if you have a lot, a very deep hierarchy, on the fine mesh you have some complicated structure. On the coarse meshes, that's not going to be resolved at all. So when you take a step on the coarse level, the truncation error is going to be huge. The solution is going to be completely wrong. It's not going to be anything. It's not going to be any representation of the continuum solution that you're interested in. But that's okay in the sense that after this coarse time step, it's garbage, but you're going to inject the fine solution back to that core step. And so you're always going to be correcting it in the region where there's an overlapping fine grid. The potential for the problem is, well, in the region of the coarse grid where you are using those values to set boundary conditions, there you want the solution to be accurate. But if it's a hyperbolic equation, the sort of the crap that's happening in the poorly resolved region is never going to propagate to the boundary in one time step. And so the fact that you're not resolving the fine scale structures on coarse meshes doesn't matter for hyperbolic equations. Of course, for elliptic equations, that's not true at all. So if you have some elliptic equation that's being sourced, say a Poisson-like equation that's being sourced by energy density, and you're not resolving the source, that's going to globally change your solution. So the way that you can sort of modify the algorithm to deal with elliptic equations, and this is, again, for a set of coupled equations where the dynamics is really being governed by hyperbolics. So it's a hyperbolic equation that's telling you how matter is moving, and then that's just, say, coupling to some Poisson-like equation for some other aspect of the problem. you, instead of on coarser levels sort of solving for the elliptic equations, you just extrapolate to the future time level from past levels. And so that's sort of going down this recursive tree, and this will make more sense when I show you the example. You just use an extrapolated solution, but then after you've evolved the hyperbolic equations up to that point, you then resolve the elliptics over the entire hierarchy, where you then include all the information from the fine meshes. Let me show you an example. Perhaps all of this will now make a little bit more sense. So here's now an example. So here's our mesh. So these are actually squares. The little triangles are just an artifact of the visualization. So this is a uniform rectangular mesh. So those are the mesh points. And also that edge is vanishing is also a visualization bug. So this is going to be time. So we're going to be evolving this. This is just a wave equation, I think. I guess we're going to be evolving this wave equation forwards in time. Initially, we have two levels of refinement. We're going to be using a 2-to-1 temporal and spatial refinement ratio. So this is our initial hierarchy, however we got it. So the first step is, again, it's recursive. So we're first going to take a big time step on the coarsest level. So we take that time step. Again, you can see here, this is not well resolved. It's not well resolved, that feature of the solution. So the coarse step over there is going to have a high truncation error. It's not going to be accurate. But again, if this is a hyperbolic equation, it's not going to propagate very far. When we now take the solution on the fine level, we want to set the boundary conditions there by interpolation in time from the coarse level. And at least here, the solution is well resolved on the coarse level. And so this should be a pretty accurate solution. So the interpolation in time should be a good boundary condition for the fine grid. And at this stage, again, if we had an elliptic equation that we wanted to solve, we don't want to solve it here because the sources aren't well resolved. It will change the solution globally. So here we just use an extrapolated solution for elliptic equations. So now we take a time step. Now we're going to take two time steps on the fine level. So we take a time step on this fine level. The boundary conditions there were set by interpolation. This is an axis, so this is an axisymmetric one. So this is the physical boundary. So that's physical boundary conditions, interpolated boundary conditions. And actually here you do solve the elliptic equations using the extrapolated boundary conditions. And now you take the second time step, and now they're in sync in time again. Now, it's at this stage of the algorithm where you can compute truncation errors, right? So we started with the same in this region of the grid. We started with the same initial conditions, 2-to-1 coarsened compared to the other one in the blue and the green. And so they're going to be different, the solutions obtained on these two meshes, by an amount that's proportional to the truncation error. So before in the injection phase of the algorithm, where we copy the fine grid to the coarse grid, we can compare them and compute the truncation error. So here you compute the truncation error and you save it. And then you inject the solution from the coarse mesh into the fine mesh. And so now at this stage, now let's do a regrid operation. So in a typical algorithm, you don't want to regrid every single time step, every so often. But what you do in a regrid is you identify the region of, so you have a truncation error threshold. You have some value that you specify. You don't want the truncation error to ever grow above a certain threshold. So every now and then, you look at the truncation error that you've computed. If you find a region of high truncation error that's above the threshold, then you add a new level there. You refine the level. If that region has moved a little bit, you move the levels accordingly. So let's imagine that here there's going to be a regrid step. And in this region, the truncation error has now grown above threshold. So now we want to add a new level. And so at this point, you introduce a new level by interpolation from the parent level. And the idea here is, again, if you have why something like this is okay, so you're saying, well, okay, now we've got a fine level. Is this solution more accurate now? Well, no, because you've just interpolated from the coarse level. But the assumption is that we're solving an equation that has smooth solutions, both in space and time. So here, presumably, the solution was below the truncation error, but it's perhaps growing with time. This might be a wave that's sort of collapsing. And so at this point, it's just barely gone above the threshold. And so now you want to introduce a fine level so that it doesn't go, that in some sense you knock it back down, the truncation error below this threshold, so that it never ever goes above that level. And now there are various suggestions in the literature. Well, if you notice this, what you actually want to do is you want to go backwards a few time steps and then introduce the fine level so that it doesn't go above the threshold. That's one way of doing it, but that complicates the code quite a bit because you need to save periodically, you need to save past copies of the hierarchy so that you can back up. And so if effectively what you really want to do, again, is assuming that the truncation error will, say, grow smoothly in time, you just set the level a little bit lower than what you really want in your solution so that when it crosses that level, you introduce this new level, assuming, well, it might go down again and then you can unrefine, but so you sort of catch it slightly before it happens. So this would be the regrid stage. And so now let's just take one more step. And now we have three levels. Again, it's recursive, so we always start on the coarsest level. So we take one step on the coarsest level. Now we go down to the next coarsest level. And now we're going to want to take two steps on this level before we inject. But it's recursive, so we first take the one step here, and now we're going to take the two steps on the finest level. So we take the time steps. They're in sync here. So here we can compute a truncation error now for this level if we wanted to introduce even a higher level. Then we do the injection. Now we go back up the tree. Now we can take one step on the second level, compute truncation error, inject. And now we can set boundary conditions again for the finest level. So we take two steps on the finest level and inject.
So is the boundary condition for those levels in between just the average of what's?
Yeah. So say for instance like what the boundary conditions are on over there on that grid.
Yeah.
It's just so you just take the coincident points on the parent level and just interpolate in time. So it depends on the accuracy that you want. If you've got a second order accurate code, second order in time is fine. If you've got a higher order accurate one, you want to save a few of the last time levels so you can use a higher order temporal interpolation. But one thing also is that it doesn't matter too much. Is that usually the way that you define the region that you're going to want to introduce a fine grid. So say there's a region of high truncation error there. You don't want the mesh to be just hugging it exactly. You want to add a little bit of a buffer zone. So presumably the solution in this region where the boundaries are is actually quite a bit lower than the truncation error. The error in the solution is quite a bit lower than the truncation threshold, which implies that it's actually very well resolved there. And so even something like, in theory, say you had like a fourth order spatial discretization, you were doing like fourth order round cutting time, and you were using second order boundary interpolation. In theory, if you went to the limit of infinite resolution, that would dominate the overall order of the scheme. But for typical resolutions, you'll find you'll actually get better than second order global convergence. The boundary interpolations don't have such a huge effect on the solution as long as you don't have a boundary sort of cutting right through a region of high truncation error. Okay, so let me just show you this one example again that I showed before. So this is critical collapse. And this might actually be the same solution or the first few time steps that I used, for example. But this is now just to show you, again, the kinds of hierarchies that you can develop in critical collapse. So again, this is a scalar field in axisymmetry, so coupled to gravity. This is actually a constrained evolution, so we are solving mixed elliptic hyperbolic system. So several hyperbolic equations and several elliptic equations. The critical phenomenon is almost a sort of a poster child example of Berger and Olliger style refinement, because you're getting small n scale features that are developing on, or that are, they're developing exponentially fast, but it's very isolated. So this Berger and Olliger algorithm can very efficiently resolve them. But also the temporal scales are commensurate with the spatial scales, and so the time subcycling helps a lot. And in this case, you know, we were thinking things were going to happen at the origin, but as I mentioned, they actually happened off-center, and we didn't know that beforehand. But because you're estimating things based on truncation error, the solution is telling you where you need your refinement, so you don't have to figure that out beforehand. So you can see that the solution starts to oscillate, and you know, again, this is where we sort of tuned it around this peak. This is where the echoing, the self-similar echoing happens. And essentially, you can't really see it here on this scale, but in the last frame, you know, there's an entire oscillation of the field that takes place. And this is sort of, if we transform to logarithmic coordinates centered around that second peak, you know, you can see that if you had a uniform grid that looked like this, well, you'd be able to resolve it perfectly fine. But the thing is, you don't know where that is a priori. So with the Cartesian grid, it's very useful to have this adaptive property of the algorithm. And again, this is the mesh structure. So this case needed 25 levels of 2-to-1 refinement to resolve that last bit. So now I'm just going to zoom in on this leftmost echoing solution. And so you can see, you know, the self-similar nature and going down to the small scales. And of course, now at this point, so this actually is a subcritical case, so a black hole didn't form. But now this is the end of this self-similar behavior. And so now these are all these waves that are traveling outwards. And now if you try to follow this, well, it's game over. You can't do it with this algorithm. Because now, so this went, you know, so these scales are now present in the problem. You've generated these small scales, now they're propagating outwards. But they're just propagating outwards at the speed of light, whereas the small scales developed on an exponentially fast time scale. But now they're just traveling outward with unit speed that would take years of, it took like a couple of days on a single CPU to get to this point. It will take years to just follow these wave fronts outwards for just a short physical distance. Okay, just to sort of give you some idea of the kind of speed up that you can get, you can just do a little simple, essentially one slide little calculation. So let's just imagine that we've got, you know, a D plus one dimensional problem, so space plus time, so these spatial dimensions. And each level we're covering, or the coarsest level, there are n points along each dimension. So we have n to the D points in our coarsest mesh. We let's assume we have a 2-to-1 spatial and temporal refinement ratio. We're going up to from a level 1 to a level L. And let's assume that we take n steps in time on the coarsest level to get the solution that we want. So it's, you know, n to the D plus 1 dimensional hypercube of points that we can discretize the space-time. And let's assume that we have a linear filling factor of a half. So each box in each linear direction is half the size of the parent one. Now, if you have an optimal solution method, the amount of computational time that it's going to take to solve discretized equations on any mesh is going to be proportional to the number of points that you have. So we have the structure in space and time, you know, these number of points, and let's assume that we're going to get a solution that's not just trivially zero everywhere. But so therefore, for the first step, we have to zero out all these points. But that operation is going to take, you know, it's going to be a very quick operation. But the important thing with how long these things takes in these computations is how it scales with the number of points. So if you have a total number of points, in this case, n to the d, roughly n to the d, the operation of zeroing all these points, you know, takes an order n to the d number of operations. So there's no way in which any algorithm can scale better than linear in the total number of points, because just reading them, writing them, just initializing them scales linearly with the number of points. Now, bad algorithms, like, you know, if you solve an elliptic equation using relaxation, for instance, that scales with some higher power than linear. But at least, you know, if you have an optimal algorithm, it scales linearly with a number of points. So let's assume that we have an optimal algorithm. And of course, the thing that's going to be different is, well, how much time is spent at each point? And let's say that it's this constant C. But with this Bergmann-Olliger style algorithm, it doesn't really matter. I mean, you're using the same algorithm for the Unigrid versus AMR, so it's going to be the same constant. And so what this estimate is for sort of the difference in time is we're just actually summing up the total number of points in a Unigrid versus this assumed hierarchy. So this is just, you know, summing up the number of points, simplifying things a little bit here. And so this sort of gives you some idea of how much time a Unigrid versus an AMR solution would take on such a kind of hierarchy. And so you can see, you know, if L is large, so if D, a three-dimensional evolution, and L is large, you know, this can be an incredibly large number. So for even the two-dimensional case that I showed you before, and that was 25 levels, that just shows you that, you know, if this thing took 2 days, you know, this is going to take more than the age of the universe. So of course, if you had a Unigrid solution, it would be very accurate everywhere compared to the AMR one, but that's not what we're interested in AMR. In some sense, we want a solution with a given accuracy, 1%, 0.1%, but we want to actually solve in a reasonable amount of time. So you can see it, in some problems, it can be a real time saver. Okay. Let's see. So here we started a bit late, but I didn't really want to go over time. So I'm just, this is not, it's again, since this would have been useful if there was another week. But there, you know, there are many algorithms that implement various AMR drivers. This is one of them. There's some documentation on the web, but I think I'll just, you know, for the sake of time, I'll just skip over this. So that's just because, so there's the Einstein toolkit, which uses this cactus drivers. You know, Luis and Steve Liebling have this, their HAD drivers. So this is just one of the paramesh, there are numerous ones, and so actually the details of that are not important. But let me just finish with a couple of remarks. So another thing, if you look at, you know, the sort of the computer science literature on mesh refinement, there's a lot beyond Bergmann and Olliger out there. But you find that there's a tremendous amount of, you know, complication that they introduced to some of these algorithms to perhaps try to make it more efficient. You know, things like space-filling curves or very, you know, sophisticated octree data structures, etc. But you'll often find, you know, looking at the, at that literature, that the examples that they use to demonstrate that they get speed-ups is they use things, you know, simple wave equations. And so it's not that they're wrong, but in some sense, the nice thing about the Einstein equations is that it's the amount of computational, that little coefficient C that I have, the amount of compute power that you have to do to solve an equation at one grid point is very, very large. You know, typically, you know, 10 to the 4 floating point operations you have to do at every single grid point. Whereas with a wave equation, it's just a few. And so in that case, if you have a very simple problem, then it really does, then in this Bergmann-Olliger algorithm, what can dominate your time is things like the interpolation and the injection and the regridding and the parallel computation and the communication. But with the Einstein equations, those things are irrelevant compared to the actual cost of solving the equations. So we can get away with very simple types of refinement algorithms, and we don't have to worry about all of these details and still get very good scaling. So it's like all of these things, you know, are essentially for free solving the Einstein equations. So that's the one nice advantage of it being complicated. And then the other comment that I want to end on is, so we have I don't think Luis covered, you know, solving elliptic equations, but one thing is elliptic equations, in particular in this, you know, if you do like finite difference in this Bergmann-Olliger style approach, is not slow. It's, in fact, you know, you often hear, you know, statements where people try to avoid elliptic equations because they say it's so slow. Well, it's only slow if you use, you know, a stupid way of solving it, like relaxation. If you use a multigrid, you know, this full approximation storage algorithm of Brandt, which is well adapted to solving non-linear elliptic equations, that's really an optimal solution method as well. It's also going to scale essentially linearly with a number of points. So on one of these with Bergen oligarchy, at least a naive way of doing it, where you're sort of solving one point several times when they're overlapping, you can think there's sort of a logarithmic, it's not exactly linear, you sort of get a logarithmic correction. But this multi-grid algorithm scales in exactly the same way as the hyperbolic algorithms on this grid. And the only thing is perhaps at worst, you've got that coefficient might be a factor of 2 or 3 times larger, but it's going to scale in exactly the same way. And just to demonstrate explicitly that 2D example that I showed you, sort of profiling it, well, it depends on how we wanted to do it. If we wanted to solve the Hamiltonian constraint, there was an equivalent evolution or hyperbolic equation, but either way, about the same number of elliptic and hyperbolic equations. And so between, 20 to 25 to 45% of the time was spent in solving the hyperbolics, 50 to 7 for the elliptics, and just the rest of the 5 to 10% in the other parts of the algorithm, computing curvature invariants, looking for apparent horizon finders, and all of the stuff associated with the mesh refinement. So they might be a little bit slower, but it scales in the same way. So the take-home message here is don't be scared of elliptic equations. If you have an elliptic equation or problem, there's a really well-developed, well-defined method that's very efficient at solving elliptic equations. Okay, so any questions? Okay, thanks.